Oh, my brothers think I don't know how to make the.
It's totally not what it is, but that is, I can't sing that low. Like. I tried.
You did. Welcome to another episode of State of Murder. We are back in the Midwest, still going through all those states, and we are in the state of Kansas.
Yeah.
State you have lived in, right?
I have lived in Kansas. I went to college in Kansas, so a small religious school in Kansas. So I know we've talked about it before because we're talking about all the rules that we had to follow that I didn't follow because I was on not academic probation, but disciplinary probation my sophomore year. Oops. I'm just a rebel. What can I say?
Yeah, it is what it is. So once again, we are at a state that I have not been to. So we're still searching for that last state that I visited.
I think it's going to be a while.
It's probably going to be a long time. We'll see.
It's okay. It's okay. We're going to start getting into states that I definitely have not been to soon.
Oh, yeah. So. And then when we get to the East Coast, it's all little teeny tiny states all over the place. We're going to figure out how to order those.
So. Oh, yeah. It's going to be a weaving map of, like, confusion because I don't, like, geography of those states I'm not great at. So we're going to have to make sure we have a map every time we announce which state we're going to next because I'll be like,
The East Coast makes me laugh because have you ever seen, it's like a meme or a comedy thing or something where they're like, yeah, when someone was drawing the states, they just went like, okay, we got enough room. They drew California and Oregon, Washington, Texas, and somewhere along the middle, they're like, maybe we're making them a little too big. They just squeeze them all.
Like when you have like writing on a poster.
Like, yeah.
Like, start, their big. Letters look all great. And then you're like, oh shit.
Here I got to fit four letters.
So that is totally what America looks like.
Yeah, so if I didn't know that it started from east to west, that's what I would have thought.
Absolutely.
All right.
Too funny.
So, what story do you got for us today?
All right. So today I'm going to be talking about the murder of Florence Knobloch. As we've always stated, we always try to do a little bit lesser known murders. And I know Selena and I had trouble finding cases for this week's episode. Now, that isn't to say that Kansas doesn't have its fair share of murders, because it does. Dennis Rader, known as the BTK Strangler, murdered women in Kansas. Truman Capote wrote his novel In Cold Blood about Richard Hickok and Perry Smith when they murdered the Clutter family. And certainly not least, I don't know if you've ever heard of them, but I definitely have. It's a story that's always interests me, are the Bloody Benders from the 1870s. And that was a family that murdered tourists in their town. And then all these people just kept disappearing around their town. And so they started to look at that creepy ass family.
So. Yeah, no, it was hard searching for a story from Kansas because you search Kansas and true crime and you get a million articles on BTK and In Cold Blood.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to kind of dive a lot deeper than in some other states.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely all of those cases have been covered. And it was pretty hard to find another one. So my case this week is going to be a little bit different. There was one book written about the murder of Florence Knobloch, but it almost was written as historical fiction. So I didn't want to base anything off of that. I know the writer for that was a librarian who really was delving deep into this. So what she did, I'm sure, is pretty factual, but I was just kind of like, I don't know. So today, all of my research on this case comes from articles written during the time of this murder. So I've had to piece together what happened to Florence from testimony and interviews all written in newspapers in 1925 and 1926. So,
wow, I'm surprised you found articles from the newspapers back then.
I know, right? So there was one website. So I'm going off of that one website. But it had all of them put together, so it worked out really well. Okay, so Florence Mazingo Knobloch and her husband John lived in a farm in Coffee County, Kansas. They had started seeing each other when Florence was 15 years old and got married 8 years later. Florence and John had one son, whom they named Roger. By most accounts, they lived a quite peaceful life on their farm for 8 years. However, on May 30th, 1925, everything would change. Florence and John and their son got up that morning around 6 a.m., just like they did every morning. However, this was a Saturday. And on Saturdays, John would go to town. They lived about 8 miles west of Burlington, Kansas. And so he would go to town to buy supplies, and he would also bring with him eggs and cream that they had collected throughout the day. That morning, he got up and he went to go milk the cows like he did every morning, except for this morning was May 30th, was known as Decoration Day. Have you ever heard of that?
I have not.
Yeah, I didn't know what the heck that was either. So, and remember, all of my articles were written in 1925, so I had to look it up. And it is what Memorial Day was known as. So Memorial Day really changed its name after World War II.
Okay, but it's still celebrated the same thing. We were just honoring.
I don't know if it's like honoring the dead, remembering the dead, and veterans probably still. And so I think the Decoration Day went to the fact that they went and decorated the tombstones.
Okay, so it's still kind of the same premise. Yes. It was just a different way of wording it.
So, exactly. So even though it was a holiday, this didn't change how farmers, so I don't know if anybody knows a farmer out there, they don't really get a day off, especially if they have livestock. Uh-huh. So that morning, John got up and took care of milking the cows, his four-year-old son, Roger, following behind him with his tin cup so he could get a glass of fresh milk. John went and fed the pigs. Well, Florence took care of the chickens, so they had some baby chicks that were in some incubators, so that was her job.
I know. Did you ever play with the little, well, I'm sure you did because you lived in farming communities, but the little baby chicks, do you ever play with them like in school? I remember when they used to bring the little baby chicks. It was so cute. I like little baby chicks, but then they grow into chickens, and chickens kind of freak me out a little.
My nephews
and I like birds.
Went blackberry picking last week, and the neighbor across the street from my parents' friends, we got to go see like all of their, so they live on a farm. And so like they had baby chicks. So my nephews got up old baby chicks for like the first time, and they had rabbits and baby sheep. So,
how cute.
Yeah, it was really, really cute. So farms are fun. As long as I don't take care of the animals. And Emmett, the second we stepped out of the car, he was like, "It stinks like cow poop here." That's like, welcome to the country, city kid.
Also, have you ever tried milk fresh from a cow? I mean, just because you mentioned the little boy, was it good?
Oh, I did not like it. It's really thick and warm.
I know. I feel like that would be not a pleasant thing to have warm milk. I know some people drink warm milk for bedtime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. Warm milk makes me think of like spoiled milk. I mean, I don't really drink milk anymore. But either way, I feel like that would be gross.
I don't like drinking milk. I've never liked drinking milk. I'm a very textural person. And so like the thick, just even like skim milk to me is really thick and viscous, and it just grosses me out. So I would not be putting my tin cup up for that. Yes. Have you ever milked a cow?
No, I have not. That also seems weird to me. And so I'm just, like even when I drank milk, I was like, okay, like I would try to just not think that it came out of a cow's teat. But then now I'm much happier drinking oat milk or almond milk
or something. Like we're city people. We're not farm people.
I am also lactose intolerant, so that definitely, I'm sure milk straight from a cow would not be good for me.
No. So let's see, where was I?
Sorry, I just wanted to know because that didn't sound that great that the little boy was like, I'm going to get milk fresh from the cow.
A lot of people do like it. So John then went and fed the pigs while Florence took care of the chickens. And then Florence went to go make breakfast for everyone. During breakfast, John asked Florence to cut his hair. So that morning, before the rest of her chores, Florence cut John and Roger's hair. At around 9 a.m., Florence called up the local bakery to find out if her order for lard was ready. She then told Ray the baker that John would be in later to get it as he was going into town. Sometime between 9 and 11 a.m., John took Roger, and that comes important later, so just So okay. Timelines are important.
Also, these people are super efficient in the morning. That she cut hair, they tended to the cows, they made breakfast. They did so much before 9 a.m.
Yeah, they did. That's the way it is on a farm.
Oh my goodness.
It sounds freaking exhausting.
Yeah.
So sometime between 9 and 11, John took Roger with him and they drove to town. Now, it had rained the night before, and due to this, the ground was soft, and John noticed that he was the first person to drive down the road, as there were no other tracks prior to his. So, I don't, dirt roads and anything, if it gets muddy, you can totally see the ruts in it, so totally can picture that. John and Roger remember waving at neighbors on their way into town, and while they were there, they stopped at the baker, bought groceries, went to a couple of different hardware stores looking for wire to fix a fence. John also stopped by his in-law's house to drop off strawberries that Florence had picked the day before. What happens next is testimony given by Sheriff Frank Hunter about what John reportedly stated happened after this. So John arrived back at home around 1 in the afternoon. So when he arrived home, he put the cream jars away outside, and then he started to carry groceries into the house. When he opened the door, he noticed a body lying on the floor. He then went outside and got the rest of his groceries and returned to the house. He then set them down and went to look at the body. So I think that's freaking weird. His story also changes later on about that, okay. But this is exactly, I'm taking the sheriff for his word on, he wrote it down right after this happened. So I'm going to believe him and his testimony that this is what John said happened.
Yeah, because the only way that would seem, like, plausible to me would be, like, if he thought the kids were playing a game or his wife was, like, I don't know.
Taking a nap in the kitchen? She was in the kitchen. I didn't know if I made that clear. So he walked through the door of the kitchen. I don't know if that's okay.
The kitchen's a little more suspicious because then it's not like, oh, you're laying on the floor in the living room playing a game or, like, doing something.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So when he came back in, after he brought his second load of groceries in, there he found Florence lying on the floor with a pillow covering her head. John then stated he went and got a quilt to cover the body, but changed his mind as it would be hard to get blood out of a quilt, and instead covered her body with an old blanket. They stated that her dress had been kind of pushed up a little bit, so he was covering her for modesty's sake. Now, I'm unsure where Roger is during this point. I know he did come back with him, but when asked about it on the stand, John does state that he believes that Roger did see the body, but that really is only mentioned. Roger's not mentioned a lot in the news articles.
How old was he again?
4. The only other thing that we find out is that he was questioned, and he does remember, he said that when he and his dad left for the morning, that he remembers hugging and saying goodbye to his mom.
Okay.
So, but that's it. After John covered Florence's body, he went and called her parents and told them to come over and be prepared for kind of a shock. So he didn't tell them before they got there that Florence was dead. They just said, come on over.
Also, has he called the police or anybody yet?
No. So he called her parents first, and then he called the sheriff. Back to back. I don't know. Now, this is where things get a little confusing because there are so many people coming and going during this time from the house. Before the sheriff could arrive, Florence's mother and father arrive, as well as a neighbor, Sam Shoup. So just remember his name for later. John showed his father-in-law her body, and during this time, he ended up lifting up the pillow to show him, and they noticed that Florence's throat was slashed from ear to ear. So all the wounds they noticed, and there was like blood on the floor and stuff. When the sheriff arrived, he noticed that there were broken dishes scattered about the room. Blood was smeared around the room in a number of places. Florence hadn't had time to sweep up the hair on the floor from when she cut her husband's hair, but there was bread that had been left on the stove to rise. So that was spilling over onto the floor. So they can guess how long bread takes. So that kind of plays a part. Because, like, if you've ever baked bread, it takes a certain amount of time to rise. So that was kind of an interesting scientific thing.
Smart to, like, use that as, like, a time.
Mm-hmm. So that's also how we know that, well, not that bread, but interestingly, the baker knew that it was 9 o'clock that Florence had called him about the lard because of where he was in his process of baking bread for the day. So I thought that was interesting. He's like, no, it was 9 o'clock because I was putting the bread here, and I do that at 9 o'clock because I started at 7 and it was 2 hours later. So he was very
specific. Look at that. People using baking bread to tell time.
Mm-hmm. So that was very interesting. John told him that Florence had had her throat cut with his old razor. Interesting fact there. When the sheriff asked where the razor was, John replied that it was his job to find it. Real helpful.
Yeah, okay.
So by 2 p.m., the doctor had arrived, and upon inspection of Florence, noticed that she had been struck twice in the head, most likely with the stove lid, and that was probably what had killed her, as there wasn't enough blood around her neck from the throat cutting. So he assumed she was dead because there wasn't a lot of blood pumping by that time.
Yeah.
So he definitely assumed that that had happened after she had been murdered. Nothing had been taken from the home. The only thing that John noticed missing was his old razor, which he stated to a family friend he was glad it was the old razor that was used and not his new one.
What a dick.
The bedroom had also been disturbed. The doors had been pulled out, and there was soot fingerprints left from the stove lid on the dresser, walls, and bedding in the bedroom. There was also footprints leading away from the house. So John was quick to point the finger at one person in particular. John stated that previously Florence had witnessed a black man standing outside of their home in the field. John knew of a black man that would sometimes come around and help out. His name was Sherman Blackie Stevenson. He had worked on the building a bridge by their property, and would sometimes come over to get water. So he would ask them for a cool drink of water after he'd been working. Stevenson had also been given a ride into town about a month prior on a Saturday. So he knew that John went to town on Saturdays. The sheriff located Stevenson around 6 a.m. on Sunday morning and had him arrested.
Okay, there's a lot of stuff to unpack in what you just said. Mm-hmm. There's one, the racism. His nickname is Blackie.
Yeah.
What the fuck, 1920s? Yeah. And like, second of all, you straight up killed your wife. Do not be blaming this guy.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of other parts of like the articles that go further on, and one of them talks about a number of townsmen and John talking about how this murder could never have been committed by a white man because a white man would never do anything like that, and it was obviously a black man that did it.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and the thing with him traveling or giving a ride into town, John goes into the fact that he had come over and was like eating strawberries with them one day, and he was just asking them like, oh, when do you drive into town to deliver your goods? And John was like, oh, on Saturdays. It happened to be on a freaking Saturday. Maybe he wanted a ride into town. It doesn't mean he was plotting some vengeance murder or whatever the fuck. And what
also, he'd have to bank that she wouldn't go with him into town.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
That the child wouldn't be there. And what is his motivation for killing her?
Exactly. And a lot of times in one of the testimony, it even said that John didn't usually take Roger into town with him. So this was kind of a unusual event that Roger got to go into town. So a lot of things that I'm kind of like, okay, not adding up, but
sounding a little suspicious to the husband here that he's making sure his child goes with him.
Yeah. So Stevenson was arrested that Sunday morning. Prior to this, the sheriff decided to call in some help from Emporia, Kansas. They had bloodhounds there that could do some tracking. So they arrived around 4:15 that afternoon. They went up to the room. So the bedroom had been kind of ransacked, I would say, but nothing taken. So what was the point of that? Although John did say that they didn't really have anything to steal in the home. They didn't keep money or anything, but still, like, okay.
Again, why would that make them a target then?
Yeah.
If they don't really have anything and it doesn't look like they have anything. I don't know. That sounds like somebody trying to set somebody up. Okay. So they just actually don't steal things. I'm sorry. I should probably listen to the whole story, but.
No, it's honest what you're responding to. And as I was reading all of this, had the exact same thoughts myself. The bloodhounds arrived at 4:15 and they put them on the scent. However, the Emporia dogs didn't find anything after 4 hours and had to stop due to exhaustion. They decided, I know, poor baby.
They worked so hard.
Yeah. They then decided to call in more hounds from Kansas City to pick up the trail. These hounds arrived Sunday morning and traveled the same route the other dogs did. So, however, these hounds tracked by one house where Cap Johnson lived. He was another black man from the community, so they arrested him as well.
Stop arresting these people who didn't do anything.
So the bloodhounds ended up stopped, like, their scenting right where Stevenson had been arrested earlier in the day. So, you know, take that as you will. I'm very skeptical. I don't know, because there were so many people in and out of that house, like, mm-hmm. more than just the three that I listed. Like, there, it was like open house, like, at this house. Every neighbor that could possibly come that lived near them came to that house the day of the murder, like, after wow. that she was found. It was just like, I'm like, why are all these people? Why are you letting all these people come around? So... Oh, and I also want to point out,
they didn't know too much about, like, DNA or contaminating crime scenes. I'm sure none of them were wearing gloves or anything.
Yeah. I also want to point out the sheriff was pretty new to being a sheriff at this time. And then I believe the coroner was also fairly new at his job. So
okay,
take that as you will. So both Cap Johnson and Stevenson were arrested. Neither man was questioned. And the Sheriff Hunter firmly believed that they had the murderer when they picked up Stevenson. So they were sure they had the right guy. After Sunday, though, a number of things went wrong. First, the sheriff had ordered the house locked up as there were experts coming to look at fingerprints and the investigation was still open. So I kind of looked into, just a quick look into, like, where fingerprinting was. So fingerprinting has been around for forever, but, like, the 1920s, they had just come up with a new form of fingerprinting, and the FBI had just adopted, like, some 12 standard thing, but they also were looking into fingerprints being a racial thing, and trying to figure out if they believe that you could tell somebody's race by their fingerprints. They're trying to prove that in the 1920s. So,
I was going to say, isn't this around the time of, like, phrenology and stuff? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Or was that, like, way before?
No, there's still stuff that's still happening.
Okay, just for anyone who doesn't know, phrenology is, like, observing the skull and, like, the shape of it and, like, the bumps on it to say that different, like, strengths and stuff like that. And they would say that minorities or, like, black people would have smaller brains and stuff, that their skull heads. Would prove that and
like
all
they
kinds
had
of
more capacity of being a criminal, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. They also were doing that in the 20s with fingerprinting, and there was I saw a cartoon spoof that in like a 1930s paper that had fingerprinting, and there were fingerprints on the wall, and the guy's like, oh, that guy will be a plumber based off of his fingerprints. So, like, just some bullshit like that was happening.
Yeah, none of those things are true.
So they did take some pictures of the fingerprints, but I don't know how great pictures of the fingerprints would be in 1925. Probably not that great. Not high definition, for sure.
No. Also, how are you matching fingerprints to other fingerprints? Like, are you just having to visually, like...
Yes.
Look at that. Oh, my God. That sounds like such a headache.
They took measurements of the 12 different areas, and so, like, they identified different kinds, and then the measurements between the each loop or swirl or whatever. So that's how they did it.
Oh, my goodness.
They locked up. The sheriff said that nobody could go into the house until the investigation would happen. So Florence's funeral was on that Tuesday. And the investigator was supposed to come and do the fingerprints evidence was arriving on Tuesday. Obviously, he didn't get to it because they don't have the fingerprint evidence because John told his in-laws to go clean the house. And when the in-laws were like, well, I thought the sheriff said that we couldn't go in. He was like, oh, don't worry about it. The sheriff's a good friend of mine. And so they went and cleaned up everything.
Wow.
So the only thing they did have were things that they collected prior to that, which was a dresser drawer and and the bedding on the bed had a right hand print with four fingers on it. However, those things went missing after they collected them. They sent them out to be examined and they don't know what happened to them after that.
Oh, great police work and just top-notch evidence collection going on here.
So the second strange thing to happen is that John mysteriously found the razor up in his bedroom on Sunday. Why he was even allowed in there when nobody was supposed to go back in there is beyond me, but he stated he went up there to get clothes for his son, and he lifted up a pair of his son's overalls on the floor that were laid out on the floor, and out came the razor covered in blood.
His son's clothes were in his room?
Yeah, because I guess Florence the morning had gotten her son ready to go to town, so she'd okay. taken off his, like, work overalls and put him in his, like, going-to-town outfit, I guess.
So this guy just keeps seeming more and more suspicious.
Yep.
He's like the guy in your other story who just, or in the one about the family, who just found the shotgun shells. Like,
oh, yes!
Look at this place! I found them!
What have I found here?
Yeah, that was what, South Dakota, or was that North Dakota?
North Dakota. That was in North Dakota.
North Dakota, yeah.
The other thing with that is, okay, so his razor was up in a box in his bedroom. Mm-hmm. His brand new razor was literally in the kitchen on a shelf. So if somebody had come in and killed his wife and then needed a razor, wouldn't they just take the nearest one? And how did they know to go to his room and look in a box for his old razor?
Also, if you're in a kitchen, I would expect there would be knives. Why would you specifically mm-hmm. need a razor when you have so much more access to other weapons?
Yeah, very true. Very true. So I don't know. So unanswered questions that, you know, pop into my head, and obviously yours as well. Mm-hmm. So by July 15th, the sheriff had no real motive and no evidence which to keep Stevenson. So the murder charge against him was dropped. It was noted also that the footprints leading from the house were the same size as Stevenson's. However, the footprints had like heel prints, and Stevenson didn't own any shoes that had a heel on. So It didn't really say what happened to the other black guy that was arrested, but I don't think anything did. I'm guessing they let him go too.
Yeah, hopefully.
Just some guy who the dogs happened to go by his house.
I know.
And they're like, oh, you did it too. Oh,
I know. Ridiculous.
God. It would take almost another month before someone else would be arrested and tried for her murder. On August 8th, shout out my birthday, 1925, John Knobloch was arrested for the murder of his wife.
Yay.
So we're going to talk a little bit about this trial. So during the trial, there were a number of neighbors that testified about John. So one sharing that he had previously witnessed John chasing a screaming Florence with a butcher knife.
Okay.
When he stopped to see what was going on, John stated that it was just a game they were playing.
He chased her around with a butcher knife? My God.
John was also accused of having inappropriate relations with one of his sister-in-laws named, I think it was Edna. And one neighbor stated that he had also shared with him that the sister-in-law had to prevent a baby from being born. Now, I'm guessing abortion, because they said illegally.
I'm guessing
they had an illegal abortion, because they also mentioned it being very dangerous. So
I don't know. Yeah, that sounds like a coat hanger thing going on.
Yeah. So I don't know. So all of these things, some of them were deemed inadmissible in court, and so they had to throw them out when the jury was reflecting on it, just so you know, just keep that in mind. Now, if you remember, prior to the sheriff arriving, Florence's parents had arrived with Sam Shoup. Now, Shoup testified that the day after the murder, John's mother had given him a bag to burn. He stated that he didn't know what was in the bag, but that it had a bad odor and smelled a lot like blood.
Oh my goodness.
So he ended up burning it, didn't look in it.
Why?
You know, Kansas people are trusting. I don't know. But I'm like, if I knew that a murder was going on. And then he later I read that he thought it was Florence's clothes maybe that he was burning, or stuff that, but they hadn't cleaned up. So yeah, no, I don't know. So thought it was maybe Florence's clothes. But either way, I don't know how they would have given him the clothes by that morning, like literally the next day. So he just wasn't thinking, I guess. A couple of neighbors shared that John had told them what he had thought had happened to Florence, stating that she must have been leaning over to clean something or pick something up, and that she had then been hit over the head twice with the stove lid. This is important later on when we come back to the time frame, but this is just kind of like the testimony that's happening at the time. So we're just learning everything as it's going on, just like they did in 1925 with the articles. So there are two journalists who sat in on the court proceedings and every day wrote an article about those court proceedings, who said what, who was testifying what. And then another neighbor, a 15-year-old girl, also testified that she saw John driving to town with his son. And when she looked up at his house, she had noticed she saw a man standing by the window, but then she couldn't really describe the man, just that he was wearing dark clothing. But this is also interesting because she stated that it was around 11 o'clock in the morning, which is why I said between 9 and 11.
Okay.
So interesting on that part. It was also shared that John did not give his fingerprints and said that he wasn't willing to help the investigation because it wasn't his job to do that kind of thing. And so he didn't seem very cooperative.
But it was his job to find the razor?
Apparently. But that was accidental. He was just getting clothes for his son.
Oh my God.
And I'm like, what were these sheriffs doing? Like, they didn't look for things? Like, I don't understand. They just went and looked. They're like, oh, yep, disheveled. Like, I just don't understand. But yet again, he was new. So when the case was closed, the jury focused on one piece of information. Did John tell people what he had thought had happened to Florence before or after the doctor and coroner had examined her? You see, John stated that he never saw the gashes in the head and that it was the doctor who told him how she died. However, the timeline of when he talks with his neighbors and is sharing how he was murdered is around the same time that the doctor and the coroner arrive.
Yeah. How would he know if he didn't look until?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the jury wanted that information, but was told that they had to decide that information for themselves with the testimony that had been provided. However, the stenographer, so you know that little court reporter, had ended up going back to Emporia and hadn't written the transcripts yet. So they didn't have that information, really. The jury came back and stated that they couldn't agree on a verdict. It was 11-1. The judge did state that nobody could know which way they were leaning. So what were they leaning to convict or were they leaning to quit? Was it like 11 saying guilty or 11 saying not guilty? However, many in the town stated that they believed that the vote was 11 to convict him.
Mm-hmm.
The district attorney decided to, everything was thrown out. So the district attorney decided to retry the case, this time focusing on John not behaving normally during the murder. You know, we always talk about we can't anticipate how somebody's going to behave until you are in that situation.
I feel like they would care that their wife got murdered. Not that the new razor wasn't used.
Yeah. And then also focusing on giving a better timeline of when the murder occurred. This was tricky because the doctor could only state that it had happened within 3 to 4 hours prior to his examination. So his examination was around 2:30 p.m. The murder happened at the earliest, he thought, around 10:30 a.m. So if John left around 11 or at 9 o'clock right after the phone call that Florence made, then he would be in town. Now, the one girl who stated that it was 11 o'clock when she and her dad were coming back from town and they saw him driving to town, that could be a possibility. Yeah. But there was a lot of townspeople who testified during this trial about his comings and goings and like what time. And so it sounded like he was in town around 10:30.
Okay.
So, you know, I still like the razor thing just really throws me because I'm like, why would somebody go up and use a razor that was in a box? It doesn't make any sense.
And so, why would he not care that she's gone? Like, he doesn't seem to be upset about it at all. Yeah. Unless maybe he hired somebody to kill her, but I don't know if they did that sort of thing. I don't know if that was possible.
And like, I just don't understand. And I think the judge in the first trial was talked about motive, and like there was no motive for him to kill her. But there's not motive all the time for domestic interpartner violence to happen, and murder happens then too. Like, it,
yeah, I mean, she might just pissed don't know. Off, and he just mm-hmm. lost it and killed her. Yeah.
In the second trial, some of the family testifies about John not wanting children, any more children than Roger, and that
was she pregnant?
It doesn't say, but it did state, like, one of the people that was testifying did say that he would kill her before she had another baby. So there's some weird things going on, but there was a lot of people that were like, no, they had a really great relationship. A lot of his family and her family testified. Her mom testified that they had a very good relationship, that they never saw them arguing, that there was no suspicion, really, like, that anything was wrong in the household. So
yeah, I mean, that's, some people don't recognize domestic violence relationships happening either. It's all dependent on what you're able to see.
Well, and back then, I mean, if you think about it, domestic violence was like putting the woman in place anyway. Like, that wasn't necessarily a frowned upon thing. You know, so you have to also take that. So that could be just like, you know, oh, the wife was acting out or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Take it as you will. So the defense focused on his alibi, and their entire thing was just having townspeople come and testify when he came in. And he was all over town. Like, he went everywhere. Huh. It was, I mean, this is my opinion, like, he was trying for people to see him. So he talked to as many people as he possibly could. And from other testimony in the first trial, it didn't sound like he was, like, necessarily that friendly of a person. So when I mentioned that he had waved at one of the neighbors while they were driving by, the neighbor said he had never waved at him before. He's just not that friendly. He's just not that outgoing. And so that kind of was weird. And then when he was dropping off the cream, one of the guys at the creamery stated that he had noticed him just kind of sitting in his car, staring off into space for a really long time before he got out. And so he thought that was really weird. But it did prove, like, the townspeople did prove he had been in town from around 10:30 until after 12. So when he got back to the house around 1. So it's known that he got back to the house around 1.
Yeah, so, but didn't the coroner say that would he not able to, like, set a time? So couldn't it have been possible that he got home, killed her, waited a little bit, and then called everybody?
That could possibly be.
Because, I mean, how accurate are they at telling how long a body's been there in the 1920s?
Yeah, and the coroner didn't really, so this was the doctor. The coroner didn't examine her until, like, 30 hours late, like, after her supposed death. So, and the other thing that I thought was interesting is that John stated that she was kind of in rigor mortis when he came to the house, like, at 1 o'clock when he found the body. Now, I didn't look it up, but I guess I could have, like, when does rigor mortis set in for a body? But if she'd only been dead for, like, an hour, I don't know.
I think it usually happens within a few hours. Okay, depending on body temperature and other conditions, rigor mortis lasts approximately 72 hours. It says it occurs a few hours after a person or animal dies.
So she obviously had been dead for a little bit. So it's not like it happened. Yeah. And the doctor, I think, noted it as well. But I'm like, the 3 to 4 hours, I don't know.
Yeah.
So this time the jury came back and voted John not guilty of the charges of murder. Nobody has been charged with the murder of Florence since then. So there's no answer to who murdered Florence. So that's also different. I've never told a case where we don't know who has been convicted for the killing. There was a reward for information that John put up $1,000 for. John ended up moving after this. His whole life had kind of changed. He lost his farm. I think a lot of the townsfolk suspected that he did kill her. And so just different. I mean, I don't know. If let's say I didn't kill somebody, but all the town suspected me of murdering, or even if I did kill somebody, I would probably leave too.
Why would you stay there?
So John Knobloch died at the age of 66 in Fresno, California.
No way! He came here?
He came here.
Crazy.
So that is the story, the twists and turns of an unknowing of Florence. I mean, I honestly lean towards my opinion. I think John did it.
Yeah, either that or he staged or he had someone do it or something, like, and they just never found the person.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just, there's so many other, like, just weird things. Like, why did he know that they weren't supposed to clean, but he still had his in-laws clean? How did he know before he even found the old razor that the razor had been used?
Mm-hmm.
The fact that the old razor was used and not the new razor.
Yeah, because so, who would know that?
Yeah. So, like, there's just so many things. And then I think, I don't know, the timeline of, like, him telling the neighbor women how he suspected the murder happened. Like, just in the testimony, I think it's really is questionable on whether or not the doctor told him about the gashes before, because the father-in-law also didn't see it. So, like, they just knew of the throat cutting according to their testimony until the doctor. So if he's sharing, hey, I think she got beaten over the head twice, but, like, the doctor hadn't even told him that yet. How did he know that?
Yeah, how would he know?
Because he stated he didn't lift the pillow until her dad came in. So.
Yeah. I don't know. That's crazy.
Who knows? I didn't read the book that was written about this. So I wonder what her take is. She did a lot more investigating than I did. You know, I just spent a couple days reading it. So it's called Shadow on the Hill by Diana Starcenik Dean. It's out there if somebody wants to read it and see what she thinks. But as of now, there's no answers. And I'm guessing, this is pretty, it's almost 100 years ago. I'd be shocked if
any breaks came.
Breaks came from the case. But
yeah,
there we
that's
go.
Crazy. All right. Well, thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
My story this week is a little more recent than yours. My case is known as the Wichita Massacre or the Wichita Horror. It goes by a couple different names. On December 8th, 2000, the Carr brothers, not like Derek Carr, like in Fresno, who's really popular. Anyone who watches football. They were Reginald and Jonathan Carr. So they arrived in Wichita. Once they were there, they robbed Andrew.
What was the date?
December 8th, 2000. Why?
Because I've never heard of this case, and I lived there then.
Really? You were in Wichita then?
Well, I was 30 miles outside of Wichita in a really small town, but...
Okay. Yeah,
obviously, okay. I did not keep up with the news back then.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk about that.
Okay.
So once these brothers arrived, they robbed a man named Andrew Schreiber. He was a 25-year-old former Wichita State University baseball player who some articles claim he was a baseball coach. So I would assume that he was coaching since
for the Shockers.
I would guess because that's where he played, right? He crossed paths with the brothers at Come and Go convenience store, and they put him
that's
in his car.
K-U-M.
It is.
That's a gas station chain in the Midwest, and I think it's
Is it a chain? Yeah. Okay. I was just like, this is like a terrible name.
It's a Come terrible name.
It is. Okay. So they took Andrew to a few nearby ATMs, and they forced him to withdraw a total of $800. After they had the money, so the last ATM that they stopped at, one of the brothers got out, got another car, and then both of them drove to kind of this empty field near the airport. They pistol whipped him, shot out the tires of his car, and drove away in that other vehicle, leaving Schreiber stranded out there.
Mm.
A few days later, on December 11th, Ann Walenta, 55, was leaving orchestra practice with the Wichita Symphony Orchestra, where she plays the cello. And I believe she was also a music instructor at the Wichita State University. So weird connections that a lot of them are all tied to this college. But then are there a whole lot of colleges in Wichita?
And then Friend University is in Wichita, too. I think those are the only two.
So she's also, I believe she was a music teacher there as well. As she was heading home from orchestra practice, she noticed a light-colored sedan following her. When she arrived home, one of the brothers approached her with the ruse of asking for some type of help. It wasn't clear on whether he was asking for directions or what, but she was kind of suspicious because she had noticed the car had been following her for a little bit. And so she only rolled down the window a little bit, but that was loud enough to, or that was open enough for them to stick the gun in there sideways and shoot at her. Mm. Anne tried to drive away, but was shot. She was paralyzed and ended up succumbing to her wounds about 3 weeks later on January 2nd, 2001. So that's why it's not entirely sure what ruse was used or what happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because she was the only person there. Also, too, just so I don't forget, there is also a fund for her. Like, they created, like, this memorial scholarship fund for her at, I believe, Wichita State University in honor of her.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. Because apparently she was a very nice lady. She was also the librarian for the orchestra. So, like, I don't know. It said for the orchestra, so I would assume, like, just history on it and things like that. She was the librarian as well. So pretty well-liked in that community. So a few days after that, on December 14th, a group of friends arrived at the apartment of Brad Haka. He's 27 and a director of finance with Koch Financial Services. Aaron Sander, who was 29, was a former Koch employee who was pursuing a career as a priest. And Jason Beffort, 26, who was a science teacher and football coach at Augusta High School. So those, the three of them, that was their apartment. Also in the apartment were Heather Mueller, who's 25. She was a preschool teacher at St. Thomas Aquinas, who was planning on becoming a nun. And she was also Aaron's former girlfriend. So the one who's pursuing a career as a priest, that was his former girlfriend. And Jason's girlfriend, only known as, I'm going to call her Holly, because that's how that she was mentioned in the Wikipedia article. But in all the other articles, she was only known as HG. So for her initials, because of everything that happened, it's like an anonymity thing. So I'm going to call her Holly, but I don't know if that's actually her name or just a nickname she was given in the article. So they wouldn't have to keep writing HG, because some of the other articles I read kept saying HG, 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 and it got a little confusing. Holly was 25 and she was also a teacher, but again, because of the anonymity of the whole thing, they didn't really tell us where, but I believe she was also a teacher of like young kids. Probably my guess would be also at St. Thomas. That might be how everyone knew each other. So Holly was planning on spending the night with her boyfriend, Jason. So she also brought along with her, her dog, Nikki, who was a schnauzer. Around 10 p.m., Jason and Holly were getting ready for bed in Jason's ground floor bedroom. Aaron was sleeping on the couch in the living room. Heather was sleeping in Aaron's second floor bedroom, and Brad was in his room in the basement. And I thought, what a nice guy that Aaron let his ex-girlfriend sleep in the bed and he posted up on the couch. I just think, it said that they were exes, but then I wonder if like maybe it was because they were both going into the religious, because I don't know if can priests be married. I know certain religious leaders can and some can't.
I don't think so, not if you're Catholic.
Yeah, and I also don't think nuns can.
No.
Okay.
No.
So I wonder if that.
They marry God.
Yeah, so I wonder if that's why maybe they split up. It didn't really say. So I just thought that was such a good guy move that he's like, you take the bed, I will take there. And it didn't really say why they were all together or why everyone was there. They were just getting together. Before they officially went to sleep, Jason walked around the house one last time to make sure all the lights were off and that the doors were locked before he turned in. Around 11, just before Jason had fallen asleep, the porch light came on. According to Holly, she heard voices shouting, and then Jason cried out as the door to the bedroom was thrown open, and a tall black male was standing in the doorway. And this man would later be identified as Jonathan Carr. They had no idea how he even got into the house, and I tried looking it up, and there was never anything like they picked a lock or came in through a window. I still have no idea how they got in the house, but somehow they did. So Jonathan ripped the bed sheets off as Reginald threw Aaron onto the bed. Both men were armed and asked who else was in the house. After they told them about their friends, the men left to bring the others into the room. They were all told to undress and were asked if they had any money. When the group told the Cars that they could take it all, the money, anything they found in the house, whatever they wanted, the Cars made them all get into the bedroom closet. So
why did they have to undress?
I will get there, but definitely great. Money was not the only goal of this thing.
Okay.
I know. I will put a small warning. It does get a little graphic. I tried not to do crazy amount of details because it was very graphic, mm-hmm. but if it's not something you want to listen to right now, maybe pause the episode. Take a break.
Fast forward a little bit.
Yeah, fast forward a little bit. So they were ordered not to speak in the closet, and they would be yelled at if the brothers heard whispering. So it sounds like there was like a wet bar just outside of the room, like near, because the living room sounded like it was right there. Because remember, Jason's bedroom was on the ground floor. So they're all in line with the living room. Mm-hmm. So the brothers first brought Holly and Heather out and made them engage in sex acts with each other while they watched. They then took Heather back and brought out Brad and forced him to have sex with Holly. Then they took Brad back to the closet and brought out Jason to have sex with Holly. But when they discovered the two were a couple, and it doesn't really say how they discovered this. I don't know if they said something or they noticed something. Mm-hmm. I have no idea. But they stopped that because they realized that they were a real couple and then sent Jason back. And finally, they had Aaron come out. And remember, this is the guy who's going to be a priest. And he was mm-hmm. with Heather. And when he refused, they hit him in the back of the head with a pistol. Then they sent Holly back to the closet and brought Heather back out. When Aaron couldn't get aroused to have sex with Heather, the brothers beat him with a golf club. They said a golf club. Others just say that he was beaten because this is Holly's testimony from the closet. So she can't really... She heard them say that he had until 11:54 to get hard and started counting down on him by the minute. So he had basically like 2 minutes to do this. So they started counting down. They're like, it's 11:52. It's 11:53. When time was up, they returned Aaron to the closet. It didn't seem like they had punished him in any way for it and forced the other two men one at a time to have sex with Heather. After they were done, the brothers asked who had ATM cards. They then proceeded to take the group one by one to the ATM machine in Jason's truck, starting with Brad. So while Reginald was gone with Brad, Jonathan raped Holly and then returned her to the closet. After Brad returned, they then took Jason, and Aaron asked Brad if it was worth resisting since everyone was kind of thinking they're probably going to get killed anyway. Yeah. Like, is it worth it to try to fight and do something? But Brad was speechless. Like, he didn't say anything. Jonathan then pulled Heather out of the closet and raped her while Reginald was gone. When Jason returned, Holly volunteered to go next. Reginald only allowed her to put on a sweater, claiming that he liked to see her with no underwear on. And mind you, this is December in Kansas. So it is
cold as shit.
Freezing. Yes. Mm-hmm. She was ordered to drive the truck and not look at him during the drive. She asked him if they were going to hurt him, and he said no. And then she had him promise. She said, are you promised that you're not going to kill us? And he said, yeah, I'm not going to kill you guys. So after Holly got the money, which I'm really hoping was a drive-through ATM for her sake, that she didn't have to step mm-hmm. out of that car half naked and get money. And so as they were headed back, Holly had the money and Reginald was just making conversation, and he said that he wished they had met under different circumstances because they probably would have hit it off because she was cute. I know.
Oh God.
I know. Ugh. Once they arrived.
No, thank you.
Once they arrived back to the house, Reginald raped Holly and ended up ejaculating in her mouth. Mm. Holly and Heather would each be raped again by Jonathan before the two brothers began to ransack the house. So that, looking at it, that's about enough time to send the other two to go get them money. So it sounds like every time they took one, they raped someone.
The other, yeah.
In their search for money and valuables, they came across an engagement ring that was hidden in, some say a coffee tin, others say like a popcorn tin, but either way, the ring was hidden. Mm-hmm. And when they found it, Jason had told Holly that it was for her and that he had planned on proposing the following Friday before Christmas. And so that's how she found out that he was going to propose to her.
Oh.
I know. after the cars were done in the house, they led the group outside into the bitter cold. So like I said, we're in December in Kansas, so there was snow on the ground, and according to Murderpedia, the weather was about 17 degrees. So freezing, as we all know, I cannot stand the cold, so that sounds like the ultimate cold.
Yeah.
Is it get colder than that in Kansas? Yes. Is that like a warm winter? Okay.
No, it's not necessarily a warm winter, but it can get below like negative.
Oh God. And then they're naked. Okay. I'm sorry. I got off on a tangent. Yeah, just thinking about it makes me so uncomfortable because it's so cold. The women were allowed sweaters, but nothing below the waist. And the men were left completely naked and none of them were allowed to put shoes on. After realizing that they could not fit five people into the trunk of Aaron's Honda Accord, the men were put into the trunk and Jonathan and Heather were in the front seat, respectively, to drive the Accord while Holly had to go with Reginald in Jason's Dodge pickup. So she remembers seeing the clock, so it said around like 2:07 when they were in the car, and the drive was relatively short, so I'm going to say probably around like 2:15, which is about 3 hours after the attack started, it was coming to an end. So both vehicles came to a stop in an empty field, and everyone was ordered out of the cars. And this was kind of, it sounded kind of abandoned where it was. Some people were saying it's a soccer field. Other people just said it was this empty space. It's near a construction site and there's like a pond, and it's, so it's pretty isolated away from where some houses would be. They ordered everyone out of the car. Heather stood next to Aaron. Holly stood next to Jason, and Brad, they didn't tell me exactly where Brad was, but from the order of things, it sounds like he was on the other side of Holly. The cars ordered them to turn away from them and kneel into the snow. Holly heard a gunshot and then Aaron pleading no before the gun went off again. Holly heard a total of 3 gunshots before feeling the bullet hit the back of her head. She was in a daze because she wasn't falling down. She was kicked forward in the snow. And they say it was the barrette that was in her hair reflected the bullet. So it hit her, but it didn't go into her head. Uh-huh. So ultimately saved her life.
Oh my gosh.
Which, oh my God, I would buy so many of those barrettes if that was, like, just the luck of it hitting that exact
spot. Yeah, that is so crazy.
Yeah. So she played dead, fearing that she would be shot again if they knew that she had survived. So again, and I think we've talked about this in a few other cases, just that sheer strength to stay, like, because you have to imagine that hurts like hell. And you just see, and you know for sure, 3 of your friends, including your future fiance, have just been shot.
Yeah.
To stay still and play dead that's incredible. Yeah. The cars drove off in the pickup, running over the victims as they left. They didn't tell me where they ran them over or what happened. My guess is that when the truck ran them over, they maybe sank into the snow a little bit, because it doesn't seem like Holly was too injured by this, even though she felt the car run her over as well. Mm-hmm. So my guess would be, because a car running you over is definitely going to break some things.
Yeah. But
my guess is if the snow is thick enough, maybe you would just like sink into it. I don't know. So when Holly couldn't hear any other sounds, she rolled Jason over to try to save him. She remembers blood coming out of his eyes as she tried to stop the bleeding by tying her sweater around his head. Holly could see Christmas lights in the distance and decided to try for help. So naked, with a bullet wound to the head, Holly managed to walk barefoot over a mile to the house with the lights. And that's how I knew it was super isolated, because they described that she had to walk around a pond, through the construction site, over more stuff to get to that house. She knocked and rang the doorbell until a young married couple answered the door. Holly told them that they had all been shot and 3 of her friends were dead, since at the time she believed Jason to still be alive. The couple brought her blankets and went to call 911 before Holly stopped them. She feared that they wouldn't arrive in time because she thought she was dying and that she needed to tell them everything that happened before she was gone. So the couple listened to her story, and after they went and called 911. As the police were on their way, she asked them to call her mother as well as Jason's parents. The couple even remember her worrying about the children she taught at school and who would take care of them when she was gone, because she really thought she wasn't going to survive in time for the paramedics. The police were able to question Holly briefly before paramedics took her to the hospital. from what she told them, the police were able to start a search for Jason's truck. So they were able to look up the license number mm-hmm. and all of that and put the word out to radio, TV stations to be on the lookout. As all this was happening, the Carr brothers had returned to the apartment and took everything of value they could find. As one final evil act, they even killed Holly's dog, Nikki.
Oh.
I know.
God, what is with us finding, like, episodes where dogs are hurt?
Ugh. I know. I'm glad they didn't go into detail about it, yeah. because I would have.
Like, and what is up with these two guys? Like, what the fuck is wrong with, like, that is some, like, just the ongoing raping and, like.
And making them and raping fucking, each other.
Yeah. And then, oh, you're a couple, you can't. What the?
I know.
What the fuck? That, yeah. Oh my God.
I know. It is insane. And then to take it out on the dog, and then I wondered where the dog was because the dog never came into play in the beginning part. So then it makes me think they sought out the dog and killed the dog, and that breaks my heart. These people suck. Anyway, around 7:30 a.m., there was a report of the truck being spotted outside an apartment complex. So police set up a perimeter to seal off the area and then sent two officers to knock on the door. A woman named Stephanie Donnelly answered. She was Reginald's girlfriend, and they shared the apartment. Police apprehended Reginald as he tried to escape out of a window while she was talking to the police officers. After questioning Donnelly, the police found out that Jonathan was driving around in a Plymouth Fury. Just after noon, they found the car parked outside of a house. Jonathan was there with his girlfriend, Tronda Green, and he took off running as soon as he spotted the police. It was a pretty short chase. Police were able, I like that because I'm like, sucker, couldn't outrun the popo. Like, that's what you get, murderer, rapist. Police were able to link the brothers to the crimes after the gun that they used, a 380 caliber Lorson semi-automatic handgun, which I looked up and is basically what I imagine when I imagine a handgun looking like.
Okay,
so
yeah.
If you've ever pictured a handgun, this is what it looks like. It was found by a highway worker along Route 96, and again, with ballistics and all of that, they were able to match it to the bullets that they found in the tires of Andrew, and they were able to match it to Anne's murder in the car. And all of the people in the field. The trial was delayed from its scheduled date of September 9th after the defense tried to get it moved out of Wichita. They claimed that because the court of public opinion had already deemed it like, oh, everyone thinks they're guilty or that they probably did it. But I guess a case has never been moved out of Wichita before, or out of that county before. So they were like, nope, we're not going to do it. The defense then tried to delay it further by trying to get separate trials since each brother was trying to convict the other one. Again, the request was denied since many cases in which people are accused of committing crimes together are tried together. Mm-hmm. At least as far, and this was the prosecutor saying that most of them are tried together, so why would we do that separately? So Jonathan's lawyers also tried to get him declared unfit for trial, but after mental health reviews were submitted to the judge, he ruled him competent. So just to give you a little background on the brothers, Reginald Carr was born in 1978, and his brother Jonathan was born 2 years later in 1980. They grew up in Dodge City, Kansas, and their parents, who fought constantly and engaged in violence against each other, ended up getting divorced. After their parents' divorce, things didn't get any better because their mother's boyfriends and eventual second husband, who the article I read didn't say whether they were the same person or there were just multiple boyfriends before a husband. Either way, everyone she was with was just as abusive as their father. Mm-hmm. They also apparently have a sister. I never found her name anywhere, but she was apparently sexually abused by not only their father, but also the other boyfriends that mom brought around. So Reginald would get in fights at school and reportedly had a wealth of knowledge on drugs and sexual activity that starting from when he was like 6. So definitely not something little kids should know.
Yeah.
Jonathan seemed to be more of the follower and that like Reginald kind of got him to do things. And he was even suicidal at one point. He even made an attempt on his life when he was 16 by trying to drink drain cleaner, which
we already know that's terrible.
Yeah, do not do that, as we learned in the what was it, the Hi-Fi murders that I did, right? That where they tried to make them drink that. Both brothers had lengthy arrest records. The records included, well, the records included these charges, but these are mainly for Reginald because I guess the records for Jonathan were sealed. I never found any of the things that he had done. I don't know why they're sealed.
Would he have but been Reginald, under 18? Which one was, no.
Well,
no.
Reginald no, was never mind. Older, they would but during, be
20. Yeah, never mind.
Yeah, but during this case, they were, I believe, 20 and 22 or 23, depending on when his birthday was. Because some listed him as 22, some said 23. So I don't know why, but either way, I have Reginald's drug charges, and I'm assuming Jonathan's probably followed a similar path since they kind of seem to be doing things together. But Reginald's included aggravated assault, aggravated theft, drunk driving, drug charges, forgery, and even parole violation. On December 5th, 2000, Reginald was released from prison 6 months earlier than he should have been due to some, they said, math errors from his parole officers, so they miscounted something. And if you remember the date all this started, December 5th was just 2 days before this week-long event of crime took place.
Yeah.
So a lot of people are saying that if they had just done the job correctly and, like, figured out when he actually was supposed to be released, all of these people could have been spared. So the possibility of hate crimes did come up, but because they were two black men killing, well, the four white people, the young kids, and I believe the cellist was also a white woman. And I also think Andrew was white, but they didn't kill him. And so they tried to say that it was because they were all white and they were black, that it was a hate crime. But prosecutors, again, said due to the randomness of the attacks, it's unlikely that they chose them simply because they were white. Also, Reginald's girlfriend was white, so they were trying to – it didn't seem like he had an issue with that, especially, too, because of Holly's testimony. He thought she was cute, and he thought that under different circumstances, they might have hit it off. And
they both had girlfriends, and one of them had just gotten out of prison?
Yeah. Well, people in prison can have girlfriends.
I'm not saying they can't. I was like, wow, that's quick.
Yeah. Well, it didn't say that Jonathan had just gotten out of prison. It didn't sound like
Reginald, but he had a girlfriend.
Yeah, he did. And she was white. But it still drew criticism because they were saying that there was no inquiry into whether or not the brothers had used any racial slurs or expressed any hatred for whites. And a lot of these concerns have been brought up by a group called the European American Issues Forum, which I looked up and seems to have some ties to white pride movements and white nationalists. So they're trying to say basically that, oh, if this was two white guys who killed a bunch of black people, everyone would be up in arms about it being a hate crime, which not necessarily, but basically brought up by this group. But again, everyone was saying it was very random. There was no evidence that they hated white people or that they said it. It seemed more motivated by robbery and for some reason, maybe because all of the people were around their age or if only a little bit older than them, that they raped them. Because they didn't rape the other woman and they didn't attack or kill Andrew, who was also white. So if that was their ultimate goal was to kill white people, why wouldn't they have killed him when they had money? It just seems like things kind of escalated a little bit in this case.
Yeah, and escalated quickly because like their MO with the first two and then all of a sudden going to a house and doing
weird rape scenarios.
Weird sexual rape scenarios and I really to see what their mental health. I mean, they were fit to stay on trial, but like, I mean, obviously we know they probably experienced something younger, but what is with the taboo sex?
I don't know. And again, like, I don't know if it was because Andrew was around their age too. They just didn't have a woman there, but with the cellist, she was also older. She was 55. So maybe and also it didn't sound like they really took anything from her. It just sounds like they just shot her as she tried to drive off and then she died later on. But I don't know. Again, we've talked about this before too. While it's very easy to point the fingers when another race kill someone of another race to say hate crime, but sometimes they're just not. Sometimes they're really just victims of opportunity, or these people, because think about the jobs that these people had. They were teachers and in financial work, so they probably lived, and the three guys lived in that apartment, nicer neighborhood, and probably a nicer house. I mean, they had a truck outside and a Honda Accord. It didn't really say whether they were newer or older, but that could have just been the motivation of, hey, it looks like multiple people are here. It looks like they might have some money. Yeah. Let's go in and see what we can do. Because they even asked if someone was in the house. So it's not even like they knew there were a lot of people in the house. They were just trying to take what they could. And maybe they thought, I don't know, the weird rape stuff could keep them under control. I have no idea what motivates people to do such terrible things. But I mean, honestly, even if this was just two white guys coming in and killing black people of the same age, I don't, unless they were straight up KKK, they had swastikas on them, were part of groups, I wouldn't declare that a hate crime
either. Yeah, well, it's so, even like my Idaho case, when I was talking about the Native American women in the one case with Lonette, like, yes, they were white supremacists, but you couldn't prove that they picked her because she was Native American. Mm-hmm. It was looked more like opportunity. So
yeah,
something not saying that hate crimes do not happen, because they absolutely do.
Yes, they do.
Obviously, but yeah, interesting.
Yeah, but this doesn't seem motivated. But there was criticism on that. The trial started on October 7th. Holly testified at trial, and the Carr brothers were found guilty on aggravated kidnapping, aggravated robbery, rape of all victims at 12727 Birchwood Drive, which is the apartment, and of capital murder, which is basically just first degree murder in states that have the death penalty. So they were found guilty of all these things on November 15th, and they were sentenced to death. So here's where things get a little tricky as far as my research. I was trying to get a clear like date and year, and I couldn't. But somewhere along the line, Kansas Supreme Court overturned these death sentences. But then the U.S. Supreme Court was like, no, 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 we're going to reinstate them. But then I don't know where everyone, I tried to look up where they stand now, if they're either in life in prison or the death penalty. It sounds like they're still on death row. But I couldn't find anything that said definitively, this is where they are, this is where they're not. So it drew some criticism because they say that it didn't get the media attention that it deserved. Again, some of it was from that group tied to white supremacists, but I mean, some I think was just from general people researching the case, that maybe if the roles had been reversed, it might have gotten more attention. So again, we talked about this when we were talking about Marcus Wesson and things like that, the cases where there are maybe black victims, they might get not near as much of the media attention that some other cases do. Although this one seems kind of weird because the victims were all seemingly well-off white people from Kansas. So you'd think that would get the media attention. Maybe, again, when we talked about things like rape and incest, those aren't, I guess, more glamorized crimes, although murder in any way should not be glamorized. No. But they're kind of the more messy, stomach turning, like people don't want to hear about it type crimes. And so maybe that could be it as well. I don't know. There was an article I saw that said that Court TV was supposed to cover the whole trial, and then they ended up just saying they were covering opening statements, and then they didn't cover really any of it at all. Again, I don't really know why. There was some stuff that the prosecutor had mentioned about closing stuff off, not allowing media and press and all that stuff, within kind of closing the doors during the trial and things like that. And I think that was mainly out of fear that maybe white supremacist groups, because again, remember, they were very vocal about the fact that it wasn't being tried as a hate crime. So maybe this was out of protection for the trial, that they didn't want to skew the jury in any way from maybe seeing a bunch of white supremacists back it. Maybe would have changed their idea of like, either yes, I'm supporting the white supremacists, or oh, they're white supremacists, I can't be on the same side of them as them, I'm gonna go the other way. I don't know. I do think that it does deserve attention, mainly because of the fact that it was so brutal, and these poor people were just victims of opportunity. Again, I wish I knew how they broke into the house, because yeah, that's really terrifying. But apparently it made Wichita a much safer state. Like, people were arming up and security guards and security gates and screens and locks and all kinds of stuff after something like this has happens mm-hmm. when things like this happen, people go on the defensive. But yeah, but I just thought it was a good, not a good, I hate using good, I thought it was an interesting story to tell, because just again the strength of Holly, and again that's why we don't have her name, because it's a statute protecting sexual assault victims and stuff, their names mm-hmm. are never released. Yeah. And she's a survivor, so she does not get her name. So I don't know if her name's Holly. I would hope not. I hope that's just a name that they decided to use.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I decided to use it because, again, it's easier than just constantly telling you HG said this, HG said that.
Yeah.
But just, again, the strength of her to be able to play dead and still try to save her boyfriend and to go the distance to try to get help, all while bleeding, naked, freezing. Yes. I'm sure she had some type of pneumonia or frostbite at that point. Like, that's amazing. Yeah. And to have the wherewithal to be like, nope, you gotta listen to my story, because I don't know how much time I got left. This is important. These guys need to be caught. And that's amazing.
That is. She is
so wherever strong. Holly is, I hope she is living as good a life as she can, and she deserves all the best for that, for all that she went through. Mm-hmm. Same thing too with Anne's family and with Andrew for going through that. And can you imagine, like, knowing that these guys killed people after you, and how lucky that you are that all they wanted was your money. And just kind of dodging a literal bullet there.
That's a very interesting case, just with how they escalated so quickly.
Yeah. So, and I don't think we'll ever know why.
Yeah. And that I've never even really heard about it. And I was there during that time. Yeah.
Yeah.
I might have been going home for Christmas though, when it happened.
I was gonna say, it was pretty close to like when a winter break
would be. So maybe that's why.
And again, there wasn't a whole lot of media coverage.
Yeah. You would have thought I would have heard, like, during the trial, or because the trial is like during my senior year of college. So So it definitely wasn't as, I mean, I live 30 miles outside of Wichita and it wasn't super publicized. So, but I was also in college and not necessarily paying attention to the news most of the time. So I didn't have TV or anything. So.
Well, and then too, I believe the trial and everything, because if it started in October, I believe that would have been the following year. So it was either 2001 or to 2002, depending on how long. It didn't give me years after that, so I don't know if it was.
But if it was 2001, there was a lot going on around that time.
So it would have been overshadowed.
Oh, absolutely, by 9/11, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it could have been that. I don't know if it was 2001 or 2002, but either way, we were still in the wake of everything that happened with 9/11, so.
Yeah.
Again, that could have played a role if it took place in 2001, because that would have been right after everything. Even though Kansas is a little removed from New York, it still would have been a huge thing. So, I don't know. But yeah, but I wanted to share that story because, again, Holly, just the strength that she had is amazing. Oh, and they also ended up setting an award for Heather at St. Thomas Aquinas. They set up an award for eighth graders there. Like, it's like for a, called the Heather Mueller Award, and it's for exemplary character and things like that. And so they award it to a student in honor of her. I don't know if they did it just that one year, if they continue to do it, but I thought that was awesome.
Very nice. Yeah.
Yeah. The victims. And like I said, Anne has a music scholarship fund thing. It's like for a music program stuff.
It's so weird, the number of teachers that.
Yeah. That there were three teachers involved.
That's weird. If it's a random.
Yeah. Yeah, well, she was coming back from the orchestra, so they might not have known she was a teacher.
Yeah, no, it's just random, but chance. It's just a coincidence.
Yeah.
It's just really strange.
Yeah. Well, and even, too, that all of them were at that house at the same time.
Yeah.
Because remember, Heather and Holly never lived there, or that wasn't their house. So, yeah. All right. Well, that's my story.
Well, thank you.
All right, now it's time for our super fun state facts.
And cities. Yeah.
All right. Do you want to start with your city fact or do you want me to start?
No, I can start.
Okay.
If you recall, my murder happened in Coffee County, Kansas. I think that's how you pronounce it.
Oh, is it not spelled like the drink?
No, it's spelled C-O-F-F-E-Y. So,
I would say coffee.
Yeah, I will too. So I was going to talk about the nuclear power plant. It's the only nuclear power plant in Kansas, but I don't like that because I don't like that kind of energy. So, so I'm going to tell you guys about Alan Hart. So Alan Hart was born in Coffee County, Kansas on October 4th, 1890. And he was an American physician, radiologist, and tuberculosis researcher, a writer, and a novelist. And he was also the first trans man to undergo hysterectomy in the United States.
Wow.
So he underwent the surgery in 1917, and he lived the rest of his life as a man because he was a man. And he pioneered the use of X-ray photography in the detection of tuberculosis. And then also helped implement the TB screening program that has saved thousands of lives. So just wanted to give a shout out to Alan Hart. So pioneering all sorts of things. So not only, you know, for LGBTQ, but also in the field of medicine. So
That's dope.
An awesome man.
All right. My city was Wichita. And civil rights historians actually recognized Wichita as the site of the first African-American sit-in at a segregated restaurant. So the sit-in took place at Dockham Drugstore, which again is a weird name for a drugstore. I know we were talking about the convenience store early, but Dockham sounds like cut price. I don't know. Dockham Pay? I don't know. So Dockham Drugstore was a restaurant downtown. And for several weeks, starting in July of 1958, Black students occupied the whites-only stools and asked for service, refusing to budge. Eventually, the owner agreed to serve them. So awesome for those students who ultimately got service and are recognized as the first ones to stage a sit-in at a segregated restaurant. That's awesome.
Yes. Wonderful form of protest.
Yeah.
So it's right. Perfect time to talk about stuff like that right now. So
yeah,
thank you for sharing that. Way to go, Wichita.
Yeah, woohoo. So I also have the state fact this week. So in Kansas, they grow more wheat than any other state in the country. In a single year, so 365 days, Kansas produces enough wheat to bake 36 billion loaves of bread, which could feed the entire world for 2 whole weeks. That is a lot of wheat. That is a lot of bread. That's incredible.
It is.
I love bread. Bread is hands down my favorite carb in the whole world. So good job, Kansas.
Growing way to all go, the bread. Kansas. Growing all the Kansas wheat. Farmers.
Yeah, making all the bread. Well, I'm sure they don't make it all. They just do the wheat. But still, awesome.
Yep, I can picture because, you drive down any Kansas road, all you see are wheat fields.
So thank you guys for listening. And make sure you like and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at SOM Podcast. We keep things up to date and you could also find links on our Instagram. There are links to our website where you can find cool bonus stuff. There's links to some causes to help out the Black Lives Matter movement, which is still going on. And the protests are still going on here in the United States. So any way we can help them internationally or from right here in the U.S., you can find those resources here. And we also have a link to register to vote because election season is still going. So make sure you're registered, especially if you live here. Well, I'm sure you should be registered to vote anywhere you live internationally or here, but definitely here we have the right to choose the people who govern us and the people who make these decisions. In terms of our true crime cases, we have the power to elect district attorneys who represent us in these kinds of cases and
judges
and the lawmakers and the people who, in some states, we have the right to elect people, or in some cities, I think it's broken down into cities, elect the people who pick the police forces in our states, our cities. So make sure you register to vote. The link's up at our Instagram. You can find it there in the bio. make sure you check out the website. Amber posted some pictures of her birthday to Mount Rushmore. We have the world's ugliest flag from our Idaho episode.
Yes.
And tons of other bonus stuff for you after each episode you listen to. Go ahead and check it out. And if you have any corrections, if you have any cases to suggest, if you just want to say hi and let us know who you are or how much you like the show, hell, even if you want to tell us that you hate the show and we annoy you, email us at stateofmurderpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, and next week we will be traveling to Oklahoma, where the winds go sweeping down the plains.
Yep, we're going to Oklahoma next week, so stay tuned, and yeah, stay safe out there, everybody.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.